This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Earlier today, we heard from a co-editor of The Contract with America. One of the cornerstones of the contract is a welfare reform bill that will soon be voted on in the House. My guest, Larry Brown, led a study of welfare reform issues published earlier this year. He's the director of the Center on Hunger, Poverty, and Nutrition Policy at Tufts University. He previously chaired the Physician Task Force on Hunger in America. The contract's welfare reform bill, which is called the Personal Responsibility Act, would overhaul the welfare system. The contract says the bill would discourage illegitimacy and teen pregnancy by prohibiting welfare to mothers under the age of 18 who give birth out of wedlock to children. Each state would have the option of extending this prohibition to mothers age 18 to 20. I asked Brown what his research shows about the connection between welfare and teen pregnancy.
The empirical evidence from a number of studies, 60 or 70 studies over the past decade or so, shows very clearly that welfare does not cause teen pregnancies, that there is virtually no relationship whatsoever between welfare and out-of-wedlock births that are occurring in the nation today. During the period of time that single-parent families have been increasing, that is, during the past two decades, welfare benefits have actually been decreasing in the nation.
What gave you that conclusion? What information have you looked at that leads you to that conclusion?
For example, in 1994, the Urban Institute reports that AFDC, that is the major welfare program, has absolutely no effect on future childbearing among single women. In that study, they pointed out that while restricting benefits to young mothers may have no effect at all in terms of their childbearing, that there is still a political motivation for doing so, and it was anticipated that politicians would continue to focus on that, even though reduction of benefits is difficult to justify empirically.
I think there's a fundamental difference in point of view when it comes to looking at welfare programs. One point of view is that poverty is caused by the behavior of the poor. If they had more motivation, if they were more serious about education, if they looked harder for jobs, if they had the incentive to work, they wouldn't be poor. The other point of view is that poverty is caused by social and economic conditions, not by the behavior of the poor. What do you think of that?
What I think is what the research evidence shows. A 1993 Census Bureau study found that 85% of the increase of child poverty in the nation is due to low-wage jobs. The research evidence consistently shows a direct and strong and sustaining link between declines in the manufacturing base in the economy, declines in real wages, whether hourly wages or weekly wages, and the increase in poverty in America.
Let's get to what the contract with America proposes and what's under debate in Congress now. One of the proposed bills would consolidate a number of nutrition programs into a block grant to states, so food stamps, school lunch and breakfast programs, and WIC, Women, Infant, and Children, would be consolidated into a block grant to the states. And in fact, this week, a House committee voted to replace money for school lunch programs with a block grant to states. Do you have any problem with that?
I have a great problem with it because the food and nutrition programs, from food stamps to school lunch and school breakfast, are highly successful programs. Most of them have a substantial body of research evidence showing positive benefits from the health of children to the savings in terms of preventive costs in terms of government dollars. And so to suddenly be shifting these programs to the states misunderstands the fact that these programs are federalized in the first place precisely because states were not doing a good job in the 1960s and the 1970s addressing hunger among their populations, particularly vulnerable groups like children and the poor, elderly. So these were federalized because it was considered to be in the national interest that we not let the nutritional status of the population decline to such an extent that it affected children's educational opportunities and the morbidity and mortality or health and disease rates in the population. And over the years that we have had these programs in effect, we have had major successes in the arena of health.
What about the argument, though, that the federal programs require so much federal bureaucracy And the state-to-state needs are so different that it will really be an advantage to the states and to the individuals who receive the money to have the states organize the program according to the state's individual needs.
There is no such thing as an individual state need when it comes to nutrition. A six-year-old child in the first grade in Connecticut needs the same kind of nutrient standards, nutrient intake, that a child in Omaha, Nebraska needs. We have now worked out in the scientific community over a period of about 30 years what people need by age in terms of recommended dietary allowances, the RDAs. Right now, these programs are highly calibrated to see, for example, that children getting a school lunch or a school breakfast receive one-third of their recommended dietary allowances. That is a matter of law at the present time. The contract with America would end the federal nutrition standards and let states go back to whatever standards they want to have. And we would then could then have 50 standards in 50 different states, yet children of America all need the same kind of nutrient intake. The argument that is made about efficiency is one really that is laughable. The overhead for the school lunch and breakfast program on the part of the federal government is 1.8%. In other words, it is a highly, highly efficient operation that has been worked out over a number of decades. And ironically, the contract with America would let states have a higher overhead, an overhead of up to 2%.
My guest is Larry Brown. He directs the Center on Hunger, Poverty, and Nutrition Policy at Tufts University, and he led a study of welfare reform. He's also conducted a study of hunger in America. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Larry Brown, director of the Center on Hunger, Poverty, and Nutrition Policy at Tufts University, and he's led a study on welfare reform issues. Are you happy with the status quo of welfare today? Do you think the policies are very effective as they are now, or would you like to see reforms to the welfare system, different reforms perhaps than the ones the Republicans have been proposing?
One thing that left and right in this country has agreed upon, finally, is that the welfare system today is not working and it ought to be changed. But I think that the focus of that change has to be based on empirical evidence. And one of the things that we do is to treat the poor differently than the rest of us. And that is in terms of something called asset development. The federal government invests about $100 to $110 billion a year in the middle class and the wealthy by letting us write off home mortgage deductions and pre-tax retirement accounts. And those home mortgage deductions, as well as the GI loan and other investments, have really helped develop the middle class in this country over the past 20, 30, and 40 years. I think that that's a good thing that has happened. I'm not suggesting that that be changed. But when we allow the middle class to develop assets, at the same time we deny those assets to the poor, particularly people who are trying to work their way off of welfare and out of poverty. I remember testifying at a congressional committee a couple of years ago where Sergeant Lloyd Doggett, who had returned from the Gulf War, went back, was testifying. He had come back after fighting in the military, had gotten his wife and three children, put them in a van to begin looking for work because he had lost his job after going into the armed forces. They drove around for 4 weeks from state to state. He was doing odd jobs and looking for permanent work. They were living in their car. And Sergeant Doggett reported to the members of Congress that his wife kept harassing him, that the children were going hungry, they were losing weight. He had to swallow his pride and apply for food stamps. Finally, he did. And when they walked into the food stamp office, this family that had no food and no money whatsoever were found to be ineligible for food stamps because the value of their van was worth more than $4,500, which is the asset limit for cars for food stamps. And Sergeant Doggett looked at the members of Congress and said, "Do you want all of me or do you want a piece of me?" Meaning, won't you help me temporarily while I'm trying to help myself, or are you going to make me lose my van and my means of livelihood and make me actually then be in poverty for a longer period of time? We have to begin not only the rhetoric of economic independence on the part of the poor, but changing policies so that we can alter the New Deal framework that we have been in for the last 4 or 5 decades, where we've done a fairly good job of keeping people alive, but we lock them in poverty so that even their own best efforts to get out oftentimes aren't enough because of some of the unpredictable impacts of public policies.
So what would you recommend?
Well, first of all, we have to say that it is not fair if people work full-time that they bring home below poverty wages. Most Americans, most poor people as well, agree in the work ethic, agree that they should be working. But yet people working at the minimum wage today and trying to support families are making less than $10,000 a year. So if we say people should work, then we have to raise a minimum wage to see that, in fact, they have an adequate income. Now, we can do that directly by raising the minimum wage standard, as President Clinton has proposed, or we can increase the minimum wage somewhat, but augment that with what's called the earned income tax credit, which is like a negative tax credit at the end of the year that families below a certain level get a rebate from the federal government. Secondly, we have to eliminate some of the limits on assets for the poor so that, in fact, they can get on their feet. I think that a third thing that needs to happen is that we have to bite the bullet on the relationship between the ability to hold a job and child care. It is very nice rhetoric that some of the politicians are engaging in Washington that poor people should get jobs and should work if the jobs, of course, are available. But to say that to a mother who is willing to work 40 hours a week at $5 or $7 or $8 an hour, who has no capability of getting child care because there aren't adequate child care facilities or for whom child care costs are too much, it's hollow rhetoric and it's mean and it's cruel. If we really want these people to work as they say that they want to work, then we have to make it possible to work.
What are your fears about what will happen if the Republican welfare reform bill is passed?
Setting aside all of the political jargon, if the Republican welfare reform bill is passed, I anticipate that we are going to see more people in poverty in America. We are going to see more children living in poverty in America by stripping away what meager economic supports their families have to help them through difficult periods of time. And I can predict with virtual certainty, based on my experience and the scientific evidence, that we are going to see a tremendous growth in hunger in America, so that private sector agencies such as soup kitchens and food banks are not going to be able to respond to the need on even an acute or ad hoc basis, and that we are going to see more cognitive impairment in our children, and ultimately something to the level that will harm the productivity of the American workforce over the next decade or two.
I believe you've testified to Congress in the past.
I have.
I'm wondering what your impressions have been about how open Democrats and Republicans are to the testimony of expert academic witnesses like yourself. And, of course, they always hear from witnesses on both sides of whatever the issue is. But in your dealings with people in Congress, have you found them to be ideologically motivated or interested in hearing new information, even when that might contradict what they previously believed?
One-on-one members of Congress typically are just like anyone else. They can be moved by vignettes. They can be convinced by arguments based on the empirical evidence. Even some of the new freshman congressmen in the House of Representatives that I have spoken with over the last few weeks will disagree with some of the provisions in the contract with America, cutting school lunch and breakfast programs, for example. We'll say that they hope that can be changed in committee, but then we'll turn around and say, but if it goes to the floor, I promise my House leadership that I'm going to vote with them. So on a personal level, they're open and humane. On a political level, when it comes to actually voting, they're ideological lemmings who just follow whatever is going on at the time. In terms of congressional committees and hearings, a lot of times they're just stayed and set up in advance. The witnesses, it's known what will be said in advance. Alan Hassenfeld, the chairman and CEO of Hasbro, has testified that before Congress. Here he is, a Republican businessman who's testified that ending hunger is a good business decision, and that we can't let our nation disintegrate into those who have enough to eat and those who don't. But yet, this chairman of a Fortune 500 company recently told me that he will not testify before Congress again because it seems to be a political game, that they don't really listen to the facts and they don't listen to the business community saying that it is not in the long-term economic interests of America to carry such a burden of childhood poverty and childhood hunger.
You'd like to see the welfare system changed. Are there any changes proposed in the Republican welfare reform bill that you could actually get behind?
I believe that we should thank the Republican leadership for moving our country off the dime on the notion that we cannot continue to maintain the welfare system as it is, and to focus on economic productivity of American households. Despite what some Democrats say, those are major, major contributions. And I think that we then need to look at the public policy handles around how to do that based on the empirical evidence. So those are the things that I can get behind, and I hope that Democrats and academics who have studied this field will get behind. Unfortunately, the Republican leadership then went off on an ideological tangent that it was not supported by the empirical evidence, and what they're proposing to do is not going to fix the problem, but it's going to make it worse.
Dr. J. Larry Brown directs the National Center on Hunger, Poverty, and Nutrition Policy at Tufts University. On the first part of our program, we heard from Ed Gillespie, an editor of The Contract with America. This is Fresh Air.